It's late, it's dark, and in Tehran, Mumbai or Kathmandu, a woman is walking an extra 2 kilometers tonight. Not for exercise, but because it's the only street with working lights, and enough people to feel even a little bit safe. That extra 2 kilometers is the distance between a simple life and a risk assessment. That longer walk is the daily physical proof that the system is broken. Welcome to another episode of Thoughts for a More Sustainable World. In this episode, we will talk about gender equality. I'm your host, Adam, a master's student in sustainable development at KU Leuven. I'm together with my colleagues, Shutri.
Hello.
And Amir.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Well, this episode is about what happens when the state steps back and the social contract dissolves, when infrastructural neglect becomes a tool of gender-based exclusion.
We aren't talking about abstract policy failures. We are examining sustainable development through the eyes of those forced to improvise. Over the world, women are constantly building the vital systems, the shadow infrastructure that their governments fail to provide.
We will use this lens to explore key concepts of sustainable development goals, how these moves act beyond coping mechanisms to become true social innovation, and how they expose the harsh realities of environmental justice, especially in the global south. Today, we see how women build what governments won't.
That's right. Expect to have your assumptions challenged. Now, let's begin the reality check.
So for a warm-up, we'll start with a little game. Each of us has brought a short statement to this podcast, something that we have read in research papers or heard on the news. So the other two, that is, both of you, will have to guess if the statement is true or false. So, who would like to start?
Do you want to start, Ada?
Yeah, that's okay. My statement says that during the earthquake in Nepal that took place in 2015, the death toll among men was 10% lower than among women.
I think that's not true.
I'm just thinking. I don't know. I don't think so.
No, it's a true statement.
Well,
55 of the deaths were women, while 45 were men. The difference is due to cultural norms, where women were trapped indoors during the earthquake, and that restricted their movements.
I cannot believe that, honestly.
That's really surprising, actually.
Now it's my turn, right? My statement goes that 3 out of 5 women experience sexual harassment or assault in their lifetime.
That might be true. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if it's true, unfortunately.
You, Shorty?
Yes, yes. I feel, because I've read a lot of papers. Yeah, it looks very much agreeable.
But that's actually incorrect. The number lies even higher. 4 out of 5 women experience sexual harassment or assault in their lifetime, whereas the number of men lies at 2 out of 5. These abuses often occur as sexual harassment in public places, with 73% of women and 24% of men reporting harassment in locations like streets, parks, beaches, gyms, stores, buses, or subways.
Wow, that's a lot. I didn't expect that to be so much. Wow.
Yeah.
The number speaks a lot of volume, is it?
Yeah, definitely.
So, my turn, last statement. In India and above many other household chores, women spend approximately 374 hours collecting firewood for cooking each year.
That could be true, right?
Yeah, I would guess it's also true. But I'm not sure, but...
Yeah, I guess. I'm not really sure.
Well, it is correct. To put it in more perspective, 374 hours is equal to more than 2 weeks spent on collecting wood. This is often due to lack of energy at homes. Imagine the amount of time that is lost to spend with family and friends, or the time to spend with children, or time that could be used for a job or education.
Wow.
Wow. 2 weeks. That's a very long time, actually.
I can't imagine it.
Wow.
And exactly these statistics, I just wanted to show you that discrimination towards women is still very much an ongoing problem.
To start this part, we're going to listen to a voicemail by Kasia Skuratovic, a socialist and a professor from University of Ghent. She's going to talk about the importance of storytelling.
I've always loved stories, reading them, watching them, even sneaking around as a kid just to catch adults exchanging their funny experiences filled with intrigue, as I thought then when I was much, much younger. At the same time, growing up quite quiet meant that I did a lot of listening, which was okay, which it served me well, until this one day in rural Egypt, 15 years ago. I was co-creating a creative educational program then with a local French-Italian-Egyptian partner, and we were knocking literally on doors, trying to recruit women to join us. We were both women, and it was important to us to create an initiative that was very inclusive and focused on women. So in this one small house, we met a young woman. She knew my colleague, but not me, and I barely spoke Arabic. So there was part translation, part English, part Arabic. So our polite conversation was lovely, but it wasn't getting us anywhere. And I was asking questions, as I usually do. I was curious about her life, but she was very guarded. And then my colleague leaned over and nudged me and said, "Tell her your story." So I looked and I said, "Okay." So I did. I spoke about where I come from, my family, my childhood. And as I shared, I literally watched the young woman's wall coming down. And by the end of our meeting, we weren't strangers anymore. She started sharing as well. And that was really the moment when I realized that sharing about yourself, sharing stories, individual stories, personal experiences, builds trust and lowers the barriers, lowers the walls, and really connects us on a human level. That no professional or technical questionnaire will do. So that was over 15 years ago, and I still use and believe in storytelling and treat stories as a true gift. They connect us, they remind us of our shared humanity, and deepen our understanding of each other, of our uniqueness, of our experiences, at the same time connecting us around us being humans. So since then, I've learned to share more and to listen even more.
Now that we have a better view on the situation and know how valuable stories can be, I would like to tell you a story about the activism on gender inequality. This story takes place in Tehran, the capital of Iran, actually my home country. 3 years ago, large protests started in the streets of Iran due to the death of Mahsa Rejina Amini. Mahsa was a 22-year-old Kurdish woman. She got arrested by Iran's morality police for violating the country's strict dress code and died shortly after being taken into custody. Authorities claim it was due to health issues, but her family and many Iranians believe that she died from police violence.
After that, everything exploded. Women and men, teenagers, even children under 18 came into the streets. They chanted one powerful sentence: "Women, life, freedom." For many people, this was a wake-up call. They suddenly saw the violence, the control, the fear. They knew the situation was not normal, and they wanted to change that.
Also, I saw it firsthand. The protests were mostly peaceful. Women just cut their hair in public. They burnt their headscarves. It was mostly symbolic. But the government answered with bullets. Thousands were arrested and hundreds were shot and killed in the streets. Now you will hear a voice note from one of my close friends from the University of Tehran. Also, she was one of the protesters 3 years ago and wants to tell you a bit about the situation.
Honestly, those days felt like a movie scene. And what stayed with me the most was how people from completely different backgrounds, intentions, and maybe beliefs came together as one. And, you know, we stood side by side against injustice and oppression, even when we felt small, powerless, and unsure of what would come next at first. And at university, we didn't know each other really well, yet people connected instantly. And I saw genuine care, empathy, and responsibility towards strangers. And it felt like a real kind of unity, not just symbolic or performative. It wasn't just about protesting itself. It was about freedom, that shared desired life beneath everything else. And, you know, the pressure and fear were overwhelming. Not so much for our own lives, but for the safety of our loved ones and for what felt like the fragile hope of a possible future. That weight is difficult to describe, honestly. But deep down, that hope still remains. The belief that change happens gradually. And after everything that happened, after all of those sacrifices and the lives that were lost, I can say we've moved forward in countless ways. Or maybe at the very least, nothing is the same anymore.
So do you know anything about the current situation? Did it change something?
Honestly, the answer is both yes and no. Yes, the society changed. The way many men looked at women at work, at universities, in everyday life, it has definitely changed in a good way. People feel closer to each other now. There's more solidarity. 3 years ago, many girls were too afraid to loosen their headscarf, even inside the taxi. Today, some drivers actually encourage them. That tells you how much people's courage has grown. But the system, the state, that didn't change. In government buildings, the rules are still the same. Executions have increased, and even the smallest act of resistance is called political or a threat to public order.
So if I have to put it in a sentence, it means that if there is a change, it actually didn't come from the above. It came from women, from their courage and from their refusal to stay silent.
Yeah, that's true.
Across different continents, women are being more included in negotiating processes, whether that's in governments, management programs, or even on-site building projects.
Actually, yes. It has become increasingly evident that women are becoming more and more centered in certain roles and projects, whether that is in advocacy or even government and private leadership. These projects are actually helping to physically rebuild the urban environment in order to sustain and better communities across the world by making cities and neighborhood safer and more sustainable.
Yeah, this pattern is becoming a lot clearer now. However, it's also very important to acknowledge that such redevelopments have been ignored by the state for many years, and to this day, continue to be neglected.
Oh yeah, definitely. And this makes us really sit back and ask ourselves, when should we be applauding this empowerment of women? And when should we also be considering that this is taking on hours upon hours of cheap and unpaid labor?
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't the state be handling these matters in the first place? Or at least bearing a good portion of the responsibility?
I totally agree with you. And this is something that we need to be more mindful of. Even today, there are countless examples where we can evidently see women stepping in and creating various community-led initiatives, with the main purpose to rebuild the urban environment in order to enhance women's safety and make the cities and neighborhoods greener.
Yes, exactly. Even today, women are stepping up to lead communities' initiatives, like in Rajasthan, where women without formal education are trained as solar engineers. Especially with organizations like the Barefoot College, this initiative arose due to the lack of reliable energy from the government, leaving even grandmothers to step in.
Wow. I also have something from Mysore. So women in Mysore have also taken charge of waste management through initiatives like decentralized solid waste management. One remarkable woman provided health education and promoted proper recycling, making a huge environmental impact.
Wow. I have another example from Nepal, where women led the post-disaster recovery with Action Aid Nepal, establishing spaces for education and self-defense when the government failed to address safety needs. Women are constantly stepping up where the state falls short.
It's actually really impressive. But, you know, even technology is also empowering women to reclaim urban space. The block-by-block program supported by UN Habitat uses Minecraft to redesign urban spaces, allowing women to test and propose safer designs for streets and parks.
Yeah. And also I found another innovation in Iran. It's HarassWatch, a women-driven platform that uses digital maps to track harassment and sexual violence. It helps identify the areas most in need of intervention by allowing users to anonymously report incidents, making the invisible visible.
These efforts, such as the HarassWatch, show how women experiences are transforming their environments, creating safer, more inclusive spaces for everyone. We can't ignore the fact that we may be entering a time where women are rediscovering and reconnecting with their power. They are being treated as legally recognized individuals with real opinions, opportunities, and autonomy. And this is also reflected within decision-making and management schemes, such as urban planning.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. However, we need to consider providing sustainable alternatives for cities and rebuilding the urban landscape in ways that can sufficiently heal communities. That still requires secure funding and willing support from the government. Women who are doing all this intensive work can only truly witness the positive outcomes that derive from it when there are established funding pathways that help support them.
But unfortunately, in most of these programs, government intentionally disengages itself from important matters that revolve around environmental and human rights violation. It is important that women are centered in decision-making process. But I'm confused. At what point do we see this as a true depiction of women's liberation and not a systematic failure that reinforces patriarchal structures? Because all I see is powerful entities that are most responsible simply sit back and then expect the people most affected to clean up the mess.
I totally understand your confusion. And I also have another question based on all the things you have said. When does it become appropriate to suggest that the formation and development of various women-led initiatives can fall under the umbrella of patriarchal idealism? Because genuine women empowerment happens when women are given the freedom to make their own choice and have agency over what they want to participate. And this falls right into the center of our questions of, are women really having the choice in stepping into these roles?
In the end, it is also important to keep in mind that this intensive labor often is not paid well or not even paid at all. Not to mention that a large chunk of this labor is often framed in a manner that makes men-led projects to be viewed as more impactful or crucial, which as a result can lead to them getting paid better compared to women. As we have seen in this course, women's work is most of the times understood as not technical or scientific enough, and instead more supplementary.
I also want to add something to that. We have seen time and time again that privilege provides a lot of leeway to men, where if men make mistakes, they do not bear the same blame as women do. When there are certain failures within scheme that follow a bottom-up approach, the blame can often be placed on the shoulders of women.
So we are slowly reaching the end of this episode. And honestly, the way I feel right now is very different from how I felt at the beginning.
Yeah, same for me as well. This topic is really sensitive. When you see how many women and girls around the world are constantly trying, pushing forward, and yet often get injured, exhausted, or never fully reach their rights. And when you think about the generations before us that did not even have the tools and opportunities that exist today, it is heavy. But at the same time, you know, there's also hope. You can feel that these voices are being heard more than before.
That's a really important point, and I completely understand that feeling. But at the same time, it's also important to say this clearly. It should not be women alone who carry the burden of creating change.
Exactly. Because true sustainability is not just about women surviving within broken systems. True sustainability is about women changing those systems. It's about transforming the structure and the norms that created these inequalities at the first place.
And that is also how we should understand real innovation. Real innovation is not only about creative tools, platforms, or local initiative. It is about shifting power relations, changing institutional behavior, and turning women's everyday struggles into catalysts for policy and structural reform.
That's so true. The stories we shared today show how women's lived experiences can push institutions to respond. When these experiences are documented, shared, and made visible, storytelling itself becomes a form of advocacy.
But for this change to be lasting, it cannot stop at the grassroots level. These solutions need to move from local action to the system level, from community initiatives to actual policies and long-term public investment.
So the main takeaway is not only that women are capable of leading sustainable change. We already know that. The real question is whether institutions are willing to change with them.
That's so true. And thank you all for listening to this episode of Thoughts for a More Sustainable World. We hope this conversation stays with you and invites you to think differently about sustainability, responsibility, and justice. Thank you. Bye.
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 Thank you.